Good afternoon and welcome to Akron Roundtable. I'm John Stefanik, President of the Akron Roundtable Board of Directors. Akron Roundtable is brought to you today over radio station WKSU 89.7 FM from Quaker Square on the University of Akron campus in downtown Akron, Ohio. Our radio broadcast is underwritten by Cascade Audi. Today's luncheon is sponsored by WKSU 89.7. Our title sponsor throughout our 2018 season is Cleveland Clinic Akron General. Please mark your calendars now for our October 18th luncheon, when Akron Roundtable will host Cliff Devaney, Interim President and Chief Executive Officer of Summa Health, who will present on the topic, Summa Health, where we are today and a look to the future. To make a reservation for this or any of Akron Roundtable's luncheons, or to purchase a subscription to our luncheon series, please visit our website, akronroundtable.org. Today, Akron Roundtable is pleased to welcome Brigadier General Stephen A. Cheney, Chief Executive Officer of the American Security Project. I will now invite past Akron Roundtable Board Member Fran Buchholzer to introduce our speaker.
Thank you so much for joining us. I think you're really going to find the program today very timely and insightful. No longer is the subject of climate change just discussed within the confines of the environmental community. As the science, research, and evidence of climate change has grown and expanded, so has the far-reaching implications, understanding, and reality of its impact on our lives. Institutions and diverse interests, such as banking, the insurance industry, the military, International Monetary Fund, futures in the stock exchange, the harvesting of seafood, agriculture practice, real estate, Morningstar, which is a national stock rating company, airline travel, World Health Organizations, and building materials, to name a few, are all now talking about and paying attention to the implications, reality, and juxtaposition of global warming and a changing planet. However, one of the most important and critical issues I neglected to mention is the effect climate change is having on our national security, which of course is our topic today of our presentation. The American Security Project is a nonprofit, nonpartisan public policy and research organization based in Washington, D.C., whose stated goals include, one, fostering knowledge and understanding of a wide range of national security issues. Two, promoting debate about the appropriate use of American power. Three, cultivating strategic responses to 21st century challenges. Gone are the days when a nation's security can be measured by bombers and battleships. Security in this new era requires harnessing all of America's strengths, the force of our diplomacy, the might of our military, the facts of science, the vigor and competitiveness of our economy, and the power of our American ideals. Our outstanding speaker today is the CEO of the American Security Project, who served on the Security Project Board since 2007. General Cheney is a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy, wonderful school, and has over 30 years' experience as a Marine. His career included a wide variety of command and staff positions with the operating forces and the supporting establishment. Other selected highlights of his career include tours of duty as Deputy Executive Secretary for two different Secretaries of Defense, liaison to the Congressional Commission on Roles and Missions of the Armed Forces, and Inspector General of the U.S. Marine Corps. General Cheney is a graduate of the Marine Corps Command and Staff College, the Naval War College, and the University of Southern California. He was a military fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York City, where he is a member today. General Cheney has appeared on CNN, Fox, BBC, NPR, and Sky News, and many other stations worldwide discussing the national security implications of climate change and energy security. and has been quoted and had articles in Political, Foreign Affairs, and the New York Times. In addition, he's testified before Congress and the US EPA on energy, national security, climate change, and cyber. So with no more ado, it is my honor and my privilege to bring to the podium our very informed, experienced, and knowledgeable speaker, General Stephen A. Cheney, CEO of the American Security Project. General Cheney.
You know, I have to thank the Environmental Defense Fund when they worked with us a month or two back and said, can you go to Akron or Cleveland? And I said, sure, we've got a stable of admirals and generals who can come here. And they said, no, Fran wants you. And so I was told when Fran asks, she gets. So Fran, thank you very much. You can't believe what a pleasure it is to be outside the Beltway today. Many have asked, you know, how do your events go in D.C.? And I said, what's the calamity of the hour? Literally, that's the case. And it's just a pleasure to sit and see here, all you concerned citizens here today and hear about climate change. Now, you know, Churchill's the one who said, since the speed of light travels faster than the speed of sound, some people appear bright until you hear them talk. So as a Marine, I hope I don't prove that true. I do have a number of remarks I want to make. I usually or sometimes have a script. My wife tells me when you have a script, they can tell you're reading and it's terrible. So I won't have a script. But as King Henry VIII told several of his wives, I won't keep you very long. Hopefully not. All right, so much for the jokes. I do want to thank WKSU, and I will tell you one of my habits when I travel, and I travel a lot, is check in a hotel and turn on the radio for two reasons. One, I don't want to make sure the alarm's set for 4:30 in the morning. And secondly, to turn on the NPR station. And I did that last night with WKSU, and they're in the middle of their annual campaign. So if you don't give, shame on you. I listen to NPR in D.C., WAMU, routinely. I missed 1A this morning because I was traveling here. But I'm a firm supporter, and I appreciate WKSU's support. John, I appreciate that very short intro that you gave, and I certainly the Akron Roundtable, getting this kind of a crowd in a weekday is just truly remarkable. But what I have to say I think is important, and I'm not a chicken little guy to stand up there and scream the sky is falling and you're all going to die tomorrow. However, there are some huge national security implications to climate change, and I'm going to detail those for you with some anecdotal evidence. Now, Fran talked about the American Security Project, and we were founded after the 2004 election, and that whole time, 2004, 5, and 6, incorporated in 2006, by four fellows you might know, Kerry, Hagel, Hart, and Rudman, four senators, two Republican, two Democrat. And the thought at the time from Senator Kerry was that whenever he talked climate change, he got painted as the left-wing liberal that he is. And a lot of people just didn't understand him or believe his message. And he said it's so sad because he felt it, and indeed was a national security issue, as did the other three. And of course, Hagel ended up becoming our Secretary of Defense. So they said, let's put together a small nonprofit. It's not going to be of the stature or size of CSIS or Brookings or the Council on Foreign Relations. It'll be a tidy little group, but let's put eight admirals and generals on the board, three and four star, two from each service, recently retired, and let them be the standard bearers for this climate change issue, and let them talk about the security implications from a purely apolitical perspective, not Republican, not Democrat, just to tell you, here's how it's impacting your armed forces and your security, not just worldwide, but certainly here in this country. And we think that has worked. Now, we have other issues that we talk about, nuclear proliferation, asymmetric operations, terrorism, public diplomacy. I mean, there's a raft of them. But I would say climate change is perhaps turned into our number one issue of late. And it certainly has been in the headlines, as I'll talk about in a second. Now, DOD, the Department of Defense, is no stranger to climate change. In most of their documents over the last decade or so, they've written it into it. The Quadrennial Defense Review talks about climate change. The National Defense Strategy talks about climate change. Even Secretary Mattis has mentioned it and said, yes, he recognizes it as a threat, although I personally believe he's toned down his rhetoric a little bit. But they've all had climate change in them. and there are a number of threats that we have from climate change. I'll delineate five for you: sea level rise, extreme weather, food scarcity, water insecurity, resource scarcity, but to name a few. And you're certainly familiar on the weather side, given the experiences of the past week with Hurricane Florence. But I'll give you an anecdotal story. When I took over as commanding general of Parris Island in 1999, my predecessor pulled me in, and I was a young brigadier general, really excited to take over one of the most important bases in the Marine Corps. And I was thrilled to be there, and I thought, boy, I'm going to get to work with all these young men and women. We'll have drill instructors and handle the recruiting. It's going to be great. He goes, that's not your problem. He goes, your problem is going to be hurricanes. And I said, you haven't had a hurricane here in 40 years. He goes, yeah, well, you're going to have one. And Parris Island is indeed an island. There's an isthmus that goes out to it. It's about 12 feet average above mean sea level. 60 days later, Hurricane Floyd, Category 5, took dead aim at Parris Island. And then we had the problem. We had 8,000 recruits on that island, along with another 2,000 to 3,000 permanent personnel. When do we evacuate? Where is that hurricane going? Who's going to declare a state of emergency? Being Marines, we had planned for this, and we had planned well. The problem was we were relying on 200 buses from the public school system to transport us to Albany, Georgia, and if the schools didn't shut down, we weren't going anywhere. And I couldn't get the mayor or the governor to shut down the schools. Finally, the mayor did do that. We did move them to Albany, Georgia. Floyd, gratefully, did not hit us hard, but it went to North Carolina, where it severed Route 95 for 2 weeks, caused about $20 billion worth of damage and killed 68 people. I mentioned that because it's virtually a repeat of what happened last week, except they knew Florence wasn't going to Parris Island. It went straight to Wilmington, North Carolina. And, by the way, they've got severe flooding there. They have huge problems. The Marines at Camp Lejeune, which is one of our biggest bases in the United States, did not evacuate, but they have been instrumental in the helping the people in the catastrophe in North Carolina. They have a huge problem on their hands. It's one, unfortunately, that's becoming routine. When you look in the previous years, you look at Irma, Harvey, Maria, all those hurricanes are becoming more plentiful, more powerful, and they're happening more frequently. And people say, well, what's the impact on the Department of Defense? This past week, we've had 8,000 soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines who are supporting that operation in North Carolina. Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines, 2013, had 12,000 soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines go do the relief operation in the Philippines, which, by the way, killed 8,000 people. Admiral Locklear, who was the Pacific Command commander at the time, was asked what he thought were the greatest threats that he had in his whole area of operation. He said number one was climate change. And some scoffed at him and said, you know, come on, you know, it's got to be China or Russia or refugee problems. He goes, nope, it's climate change. Now, he knew that sea levels are rising, that he was going to lose his base at Diego Garcia, where a Marine brigade's worth of equipment is. He knew, of course, what happened at Typhoon Haiyan. It was going to become more frequent and happen more often. But he also knew, and I'll use this as the poster child for climate change, that the sea level rise in Bangladesh, if it rose 1 meter, they're going to lose a third of their land and 30 million refugees. Now, the sad part about that equation is it's going to rise 1 meter. We can't stop it. We can eventually stop sea level rise, but we're not going to stop that 1 meter in the next 10 to 20 years. So they have a crisis on their hand that is unbelievable, and the premier has already said it's a number one crisis they've got. What do they do with 30 million people? And they're not going to India. They're not going to Myanmar. Maybe they can accommodate them on land. Maybe they can end up somewhere else like Indonesia, which, by the way, is the largest Muslim country in the world with a huge ISIS footprint. So I think you get my point here. It's creating instability. Now, I break this into two sections. I call it strategic and tactical. Here are the strategic threats that are accelerated by climate change, and I'll walk it around the world just a little bit. I'm going to start with Africa, and we'll talk about Lake Chad. Google it. It's interesting to look at the maps. 40 years ago, since the 40 years, it's lost 90% of its water. So now you've got another 20 to 30 million people who have no water source, no agriculture, who have to move. And where are they moving? Are they moving to Niger? That's where Boko Haram is. Are they moving north? I think so. So when you talk to our European friends who have a huge immigration problems, certainly created by the Arab Spring and the conflict in Syria, they're going to have one that's much worse when these people start moving north. Speaking of north, I'll move up to sub-Saharan Africa and talk about Mali. About 5 years ago, the Tuaregs, with climate change, lost all their crops, worst drought in their history. So they moved north in Mali. Well, they weren't welcome there. So it started the insurrection in Mali, and the French went down and suppressed that insurrection. But what a lot of people don't understand is the number one supplier of logistics for that whole operation was the United States. So let me move a little bit farther to the east and talk just a bit about Syria. And everybody's familiar with Syria and what happened there. But you may not know that from 2007 to 2011, they had the greatest drought in their history. Virtually all their agriculture dried up. So the farmers all moved to the cities, particularly one, Aleppo. So I think everybody in here knows what Aleppo is, I think. What that caused, of course, was an influx of huge population, instability, and a great target for two people. One was Assad, who barrel-bombed them routinely, and the second was ISIS, which decided here's a prime target for recruitment, and it was and still remains today. So let me walk a little bit farther to the, let me go back a little bit farther to the west and talk about the Arab Spring. Russia in 2010 had one of the greatest forest fires in its history, decimated the wheat crop. So as a consequence, Putin embargoed wheat in Russia, and I've got a video clip of that that's in a movie, the movie The Age of Consequences. You ought to see it. But what happened there was their number one target for export was Egypt in the Middle East. So they stopped exporting wheat to the Middle East. It threw all the wheat prices through the roof. Happened to coincide about the same time as Arab Spring. So there was a huge economic calamity in Egypt and some of the other countries there you're all familiar with. It was a contributor or an accelerant to instability in the Arab Spring. We don't say it caused the Arab Spring, but it contributed to it. Moving back again farther east, I talked about Bangladesh and the problems associated with Bangladesh. The Philippines and Haiyan, which, by the way, had the highest recorded wind speed of any hurricane in history, well over 250 miles an hour, and that's starting to be a repetitive act. You all probably saw the Philippines typhoon that happened last week, which is just causing immense problems. So this is what I call the strategic side, that we have to react not only to the humanitarian side of helping people, but we have to decide where conflict is going to be, where it's going to contribute to instability, what the Department of Defense has to do to help fix that or react to it, and eventually it'll end up in your pocketbook, because we're paying for those soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines to go out there and do their jobs. And if they keep having to do that instead of doing their normal jobs, it's going to be a real problem. So let me bring this back onto the what I call the tactical side. And I call it tactical because it impacts us daily here, our lives here in the United States. It's our bases and stations. I mentioned Parris Island, but the real poster child here in the United States for climate change is the naval station in Norfolk. Norfolk is already going underwater. They have a dual-fold problem. One, their land is sinking. Second, the water is rising. Do the math. Then when you add in catastrophic weather from floods, they had to close the base 12 times last year due to catastrophic flooding. What does that cause? The sailors can't get to the ships. The ships can't get to the piers. The ships can't deploy. I mean, it is a phenomenal problem. And it's one, by the way, they're all familiar with. It's affecting everybody in the Hampton Roads area. They've got a task force working on it. They're not going to stop the sinking of the land, that's for sure. And the climate change and the sea level rise is going to continue to occur unless we fix that, too. They have to budget for that. They're already spending money to raise all the piers in Norfolk. It is a big problem, and eventually they might have to move that base, which, by the way, is the largest naval base in the world, our largest naval base. Moving south a little bit, I mentioned Parris Island, but you can look at Eglin Air Force Base in Florida. That closed a half dozen times last year because of flooding. And you can walk all the way around the United States to all our bases and stations. I was in North Carolina a couple of weeks ago. I had somebody from Fort Bragg. Fort Bragg has increased its black flag days by almost 100%. What I mean by black flag is when the temperature and humidity reaches a specific level, they have to shut down training. Now, that's just becoming a routine basis in the summer. And if you can't train, you can't deploy. So it indeed is a big problem at Bragg, and it's a problem at all our bases and stations. And then you walk around to the West Coast, where I was at Camp Pendleton. We used to have fires on Camp Pendleton all the time during the dry season, but never like we've had the last couple of years. Shuts the base down. Your Marines end up spending most of their time fighting fires. And by the way, the Marines spent a lot of their time this year fighting forest fires in California, which were the worst in their history. So lastly, I'll close on Ohio. You're thinking, well, how does this impact here? Your Great Lakes are increasing in temperature, and I know you've all seen the algae blooms that you had here. That's just going to get worse. Your flooding is going to get worse. You're going to get deforested. You're going to lose forests here. These will all contribute to your economy or decontribute to your economy. You're going to have problems climate change related. So it's just a fact of life. Lastly, people ask me, what's the solution here? And the solution is stop emitting CO2. I mean, that's clear and simple. The science is there. It's proven. We know the atmosphere is increasing in temperature. We know it's caused climate change. And I could talk about this. I am not the scientist here. I can give you one. But we know that fossil fuel burning is what's causing climate change. And we need to limit CO2 whatever way you want to limit it. Now, a lot of people don't like the word tax, i.e. a carbon tax. Okay, don't call it that. Call it a cap and trade, or call it something else as a way to get rid of it. I think burning of fossil fuels is a dangerous thing. We need to get off of coal. Natural gas is a bridge fuel. It's better and cleaner than coal. It still burns nonetheless. Renewables are significantly better, and I can give lots of anecdotal stories on renewables. Perhaps one of my best is when I flew into Charleston 2 weeks ago. The Boeing plant that makes the 787 Dreamliner there is entirely solar powered. Texas last year, by the way, had one day in November where the entire state was basically powered by renewables, wind and solar. You don't hear that very often from Secretary Perry. North Carolina, by the way, is the number two state in the country on solar power. I found that very interesting and growing rapidly. So there are ways to get off of this addiction to fossil fuel. And then last one I'll close with, the number one consumer of fossil fuels in the United States, the Department of Defense. Thousands of aircraft flying a day, burning fuel. They have all now flown at some time or another on biofuels. So we know they can fly on biofuels. The rap on biofuels is it's so expensive. But that cost is coming down fast. And eventually biofuels, I think in the next 2 to 3 years, will be the cost of normal gas. And that's but one solution here. Secretary Mattis, when he was the commanding general of the 1st Marine Division over in Iraq, said, get me off this tether of fossil fuels. And what he meant there was, wherever he had to go, he had a whole train of refuelers refueling all the equipment that he had and generators. Couldn't do it without fossil fuels. And he said, my God, it's just, they lost over 1,000 soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines killed defending fuel convoys in Iraq and Afghanistan. Killed. You know, we need to get off of that dependency, and he recognized that. Well, I hope I haven't bored you too long here. I've given you some food for thought. I bounced around a little bit, but this is our topic. You need to be concerned about it. There is a national security issue related here. And as I tell a lot of folks, I'm a little on the tail end of life here, so it's not going to be the impact on me. But my grandkids and great-grandkids, they're going to be severely impacted by this if we don't do something about it today. So with that, Fran, I'll close and turn it over to the Q&A. Thank you very much.
Thank you, General Cheney, for your informative presentation. Maybe a bit of a wake-up call for us here. We appreciate that. Our speaker has graciously agreed to respond to questions, and Karen Talbot, a member of our Board of Directors, will moderate the Q&A. As a reminder, you can submit questions electronically or via the note cards on your table. Karen?
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. And, General, thank you so much for being with us today. It's really, really informative. A question is, I guess, about you personally, and that is, what brought you to the American Security Project, and specifically to focus on the issue of climate change and national security?
No, it's a great question, and it is indeed personal. When that organization was formed, I mentioned the flag officers that were brought to the organization. One of them was an admiral named Tony Zinni. Some may remember, Central Command Commander, 4-star. And he ended up retiring to become CEO of a very large defense company. And in extremis, they needed a Marine. And at the time, I happened to know John Kerry and Secretary, then Senator Hagel. And they said, we got a guy, I think, who can do this pretty quick. And I got drafted. But I certainly believed in the premise behind the organization, as do all my contemporaries on the board right now. We deeply felt that this is an issue. Nonpartisan, you know, it's not Democrat, it's not Republican, although it gets painted that way these days, and it's kind of sad, some of the things that have occurred in terms of the Paris Accord and the Clean Power Plan and some other things that we think were helpful, haven't necessarily solved the problem, but made steps that way. But we believed in it, and that's how I got associated with it.
If you had to prioritize, what would you say is the number one threat to national security from climate change facing the United States today?
Well, I certainly walked around the world with you, and I showed you our bases and stations. No doubt about sea level rise is the one impacting the bases and stations the most. Interestingly, we had the premier of Fiji in our office a couple months ago, and Fiji's going underwater. I mean, it's just a fact. They're looking for a place to move their entire population. So you might, and some people hesitate when I use the word deny. He's not denying. He's leaving. He's looking for a place to put his country. So that's coming. And sea level rise is occurring here, whether you like it or not. And you can see it all the way. People down in Miami, Florida, have a real problem. You know, I wouldn't be buying coastal property in Miami. But I know some who do and think, nah, this is not going to impact me. And surprise, it's really going to impact you. I was down at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, it was about 2 months ago, I guess. And those barrier islands where the Marines, by the way, do a lot of their practice, I'd be interested to see what they look like today after Florence. Could well be gone. And some would say, oh, that's okay. The beach has moved inland another 50 miles. It's still a beach. It's not the same. It is just not the same. They're going to have to look for other bases and places to train, as are all our armed services here in the United States.
There was an article addressing climate change cited that a draft climate change report published by the New York Times estimated that the sea level rise of 4 to 7 inches is very likely by the year 2030. And the report also estimates the potential for up to 8 feet of sea level rise by the year 2100. Would you agree with that report? And if it were true, wouldn't that mean that we would be eliminating a lot of southern Florida out of all of this?
Well, again, I said I'm not the scientist here, but just sticking my toe in the water, I certainly agree with it. I think it's, in the near term, that's an underestimate, that level's going to increase much higher and much faster. I mentioned that the train has left the station and it's cooked in. Certainly it has for Bangladesh. They realize that that 1 meter, they're going to have that 1 meter increase by 2030, probably, and they got to do something about it. And that's cooked in. I mean, that's coming. So things like the Paris Accord, which attempted to limit the amount of CO2 in the environment, in fact, you could set your own limits under the Paris Accord, was but one start to do it. And we have since pulled out of the Paris Accord. So there are ways to do this, but it's just going to happen. Two other examples that I use frequently about pollution and CO2. When I first was commissioned, my first duty station was Camp Pendleton in California, which, by the way, is the only real undeveloped land in between San Diego and Los Angeles if you drive up Route 5. If Pendleton wasn't there, and I know the Environmental Defense Fund knows as well, it would be all condominiums. And our bases and stations are good stewards of the environment, and they were at Camp Pendleton. But when I was there, certainly routine during the spring and summer, the haze would just come right down from Los Angeles and engulf the whole base. This is 50 miles to the south of Los Angeles. 10 years later, mid-80s, not as bad. 10 years later in the 90s, hardly there at all. Now gone. Why is that? The catalytic converter. We limited emissions from cars. It was a pretty simple equation. It worked. Now, for those who travel internationally, and I'm sure most of you do, if you've been to Beijing in the last decade, and I have, you can't breathe there on many days. When I was out of the embassy, you were not allowed to go outside. It was just so bad, and that's a routine occurrence in Beijing. Funny, when they have the Olympics, they outlaw all cars for a couple of weeks, and voila, the sky's cleaned up. Gee, I wonder how that happened. Pretty simple equation there, too. The good and the bad part about this is the Chinese recognize it and know it. The bad part is they've got such an exploding population, they got to provide power for them. So they're continuing to build coal-fired power plants. In the same vein, they're also building renewables. They have the biggest investment in solar in the world. Three Gorges Dam is not the most ecologically proper place, but nonetheless, it's a renewable. So they're using virtually every way they can create power. I just wish they weren't doing it with coal.
You saw, General, that we have a lot of students here with us today, which we're always glad to have them here. What can we do to better educate them and their peers around the country about how important this issue of climate change is?
Well, I met all you young folks earlier, the high school students, and I was serious when I said, it's not going to impact my life too much. I'm kind of on the tail end. It's going to get yours for sure and your kids for sure. And you're thinking, well, that's a ways off. Nah, it's coming. Trust me, it's coming. And that's why we we at ASP go to a lot of schools and universities, institutions, talk about it. And a lot of time that groundswell starts with the student body population who understand the issue or get into the issue a little bit and say, yeah, there's a problem here, and look at it and say, and I'm concerned about it, removing the politics from the issue. And hopefully you haven't decided right away which party you are. Either way, you're still looking at it, and it's kind of a clean slate. But I think that gives you an open mind here to look at this issue, and you can Google it. You can certainly Google or go on our website, AmericanSecurityProject.org, and get all kinds of stuff that we put out almost weekly. But sometimes you get inundated by it, and you can't understand what it all is. But I encourage you to do it, because you can see what the impact long-term is going to be wherever you are going. As I mentioned, I travel a fair amount. I've taken this issue to Europe. I just got back from Sweden in June and talked to it about them. And they look at us and kind of think, you know, you really don't get it. And the example I use there is if you pull up to a gas pump in anywhere in Europe, pretty much, and you're going to pay somewhere between $8 to $12 a gallon of gas. So what are you paying here? $2.50, $3 a gallon, maybe? And you look at that, and so they look at it, and they go, one, it's incredibly expensive. Secondly, we're polluting like crazy, so we need to get off fossil fuels. And a couple of the countries now are going to the point of saying we will no longer have internal combustion cars in a decade, which is incredible. But that's but one way to do it. And they kind of look down on us and say, how come you guys can't get with it? And again, we're the lone country that now has not signed the Paris Accord. Even China and Russia have signed up to that. So it's something we need to do. But the youngsters are the future of our country, as I certainly saw when I was at Paris Island. And if you all don't get the message, it's just going to get worse, and you're going to be involved with having incredible problems 50, 100 years from now. And trust me, you'll be here 50 years from now, but I won't be. So I put that responsibility on you guys.
Someone in the audience wants to know some specifics about what can industries and companies do to address the impact on climate change.
Well, I used my anecdotal story about the Boeing plant in Charleston, and don't think that Boeing did that out of the goodness of their heart. They're looking at the bottom line, and here is a renewable source of power that'll last forever. Now, we all are familiar with the drawbacks of solar power, i.e. the sun goes down at night, no power, and hopefully we'll have storage enough overnight to keep that power source going. But I will tell you the technology and science behind batteries is increasing dramatically, so power storage will get much better than it has been in the past. I think eventually you're going to see this will be a business decision, that business makers will go, it costs us so much money to burn coal and gas and oil that why don't we have renewable energy? It's here every day and we don't pay a thing for it. The Department of Defense has a program called Net Zero for its bases and stations. And what that means is the bases would produce more power than they would consume. And you think, how can that be? And I'll give you a couple of examples. Nellis Air Force Base in Las Vegas has one of the biggest solar arrays in the country, totally self-sufficient on power, in fact, selling power back to the grid. Pretty amazing, wouldn't you say? If I was the base commander like I was at Paris Island, I'd say, my God, I'm totally independent of the local power grid. At Paris Island, whenever we had a big thunderstorm and it cut our power line to the base, to the shore, we had to fire up an oil-fired power plant that we had on base that was from World War II. It was horrible. Paris Island's going solar. They're building one of the biggest solar arrays in South Carolina that we have. So the bases are getting the message. The commanders understand it. We can do this, but it's just going to be a long time.
Several of the questions had to do with sea levels, and so someone is asking, it said, you mentioned sea levels multiple times. How can we influence that, and what steps can we take to lower sea levels across the world?
Well, I'll tell you what Paris Island's doing. It's not lowering the level. They're building a seawall. And that's what we call, there's adaptation and there's mitigation. And the near term, as I told you, the trains left the station, that water's going up. Paris Island knows it. And so they're putting into the budget to build a seawall around Paris Island. I find it hard to believe, but they are. Huge problem. So that's the near term. Places like Miami can't do that. If you're familiar with the geology of Miami, it's porous underneath, and the water is just coming up underneath. Whether they build a seawall or not, they're going to be inundated with water. So then you get long-term, what's the mitigation side of the house? And as I said earlier, I'm an all-the-above guy. Whatever you want to call it, we need to reduce CO2 emissions, cap and trade, carbon tax, subsidizing some of these industries. That is the way to go and stop the CO2 from in the atmosphere. Now, there are some ways to purge CO2 out of the atmosphere. And again, I'm not the scientist here. But those need to be invested in and worked on. Alternative power sources, fusion power, if you're not familiar with it, I am more than intimate with fusion power, is on the cusp of a huge breakthrough. If we get fusion power, a lot of these will be put out in a heartbeat. Nuclear power, and some say, oh my God, nuclear power, it's terrible, terrible. Nuclear power does not emit any CO2. I'll just put it that way. And it's been incredibly safe. We've got, you know who pioneered the use of nuclear power was the United States Navy. And they've got some 60-plus small modular reactors running under and over the water in the world right now. And they've done it safely, since the Nautilus back in the mid-50s. So that can be done. And people say, oh, my God, how can you be for nuclear power? Well, I am a nuclear power proponent from that perspective. I'm well familiar with the drawbacks of nuclear power, which we all are. What do you do with the residue? How do you reprocess? How do you make sure it's safe? You know, and the big incidents, Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, and Fukushima, were real anomalies over the last 50 years. They were tragic, of course, and we need to prevent those. But there are ways to stop CO2 emissions, and that's what we need to do.
I'd be bringing it just a little closer to home, and that is, what's the one thing that we should be doing as Ohioans right now to support the kind of action that we need to seek relative to climate change?
You know, that's a great question, and I'm glad to be here to address it. We are in Washington, D.C., and I told some folks, we do a fair amount of work on the Hill. And I would say, is it lobbying? Yes, it's lobbying to a point. And to a point, for instance, in the National Defense Authorization Act, we desired that Congress at least put something in there which told the Department of Defense to look at climate change and its impact on its bases and stations and list those that are most impacted. And I'm pleased to say we were successful in that last year. It didn't cost them anything. I mean, it's just a study. You're not putting billions of dollars towards this, but let them recognize what the impact and what the threat is. So here, again, is the problem of talking to your politicians that are influential not only in Washington, but here in the state and local level. I often tell folks when we go out and talk about climate change, the mayors and the governors get it a lot better than we do in Washington, D.C., and I firmly believe that. We had multiple states come back after we withdrew from the Paris Accord and say, I don't care what the federal government did. My state's going to adhere to the Paris Accord. And they have. And states can do that on their own. And they recognize the benefit to their own people. And that's what I encourage you to do, is talk to your mayors and governor and your state legislatures and say, we're going to adhere to the precepts of the Paris Accord, or limit our CO2 emissions, or at least provide some type of incentives to those to go to alternative energies or renewable energies. And understand the impact that it's got on your military folks. You know, there's a battalion at Camp Lejeune today that was due to rotate to Norway last week and relieve the battalion there. They're not going because they're doing hurricane relief in North Carolina. So the young men and women, Marines that have been deployed for 6+ months to Norway aren't coming home. They're staying there until that other battalion helps with the hurricane. Now, I understand all that, and it's all good to go, but that just gives you another example of the impact of the United States military, and Ohio's not exempt from that. You are going to continue to see impacts from climate change in a variety of ways that I've already pointed out, perhaps not as severe as those on the coasts that are in real trouble, like Norfolk or Florida, but nonetheless, you will see the impact. So I encourage you to look at the material that's out there, look at the science, talk to your legislatures, and tell them, legislators, when stuff comes up in Congress, when legislation comes up, that they ought to at least talk about it from a nonpartisan perspective. Say, what impact is this going to have on us and our country, and how can we fix this without saying it's a Democrat issue or it's a Republican issue, it's a national security issue.
This may be a guesstimate, but the question is, how much does the military have to budget to counter climate change effects?
Boy, what a tough question that is. I cannot give you a specific number, and nor can they. But I will tell you this. When Admiral Locklear talked about his number one threat was climate change, and then he talked about Typhoon Haiyan and the humanitarian response to that, they aren't stupid. The military is good at planning. They're really good at planning. So they're going to sit down with their, what we call J5 planning cell, and say, how many hurricanes do you think we're going to have next year? What size of catastrophe do you think it's going to be? I assure you that the Pacific Command will look at Haiyan and the typhoon they had last week in the Philippines. We can plan on having one of those next year. So how much did that cost us? And then they will put that into their budget of the combatant commander, and it will go back to this, what we call the services, and then the services will budget for it. So there is a science to that process somewhat. They can't predict all of it, but they can predict some of it. The base commanders now, like always at Paris Island, has got to look out and say, how much is the seawall going to cost? Put it in the budget. And that's where the legislatures come in, by the way, in approving the military construction budget, which, by the way, all your legislators love to have military construction on their bases in their states, because that feeds the local economy. Maybe that's a little bit of the plus side, so to speak. So I cannot give you a specific figure, but I can tell you it's on their mind big time. And in all their budgets, they're planning on catastrophic response to hurricanes, to tragic weather. They're looking at refugees and what they're going to have to do to help assist in those problems, particularly in Southeast Asia. So it's an expense.
Well, we have time for one last question, and we'd like to conclude with one, sort of a fun one, if you will. And this is submitted by the audience member saying, will Navy beat Army this year?
Well, everybody here is familiar that for 14 years, Navy beat Army. And then that string was broken for the last 2 years. So, you know, I look for inspiration to the Cleveland Browns. didn't they tie a game, I think? You know, but I mean, look at the Cleveland Indians. I mean, we got our own Washington Nationals in D.C. It's so sad. And I spent 44 years as a Washington Capitals hockey fan, 44 years. And they finally win the Stanley Cup, so hope springs eternal. And I'm 99.9% confident Navy will beat Army this year. Thank you very much.
General Cheney, thank you so much for being with us today. On behalf of Akron Roundtable, it is my pleasure to present to you a contemplative sun as a memento of your visit with us this afternoon. This celebratory work of art was designed exclusively for Akron Roundtable by a local artist, Don Drum.
Whoa. This is very nice.
That concludes our program. Thank you for being with us today, and we hope to see you again next month. Thank you. Have a great day.